sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. The Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist who practices at the Mayo Clinic. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, it's football season, so it's time to talk about concussions. And later, how to spot and manage health misinformation. But first, today, we're delving into a topic of paramount importance, concussions. In a world where sports collisions and battlefield hazards are an unfortunate reality, understanding the implications of concussions is essential. So today, we'll explore the latest advancements in diagnosis, treatment, and prevention, shedding light on the profound impact of brain injuries on individuals and communities. We'll navigate the intricate landscape of brain injuries with Dr. Assad. He is a distinguished neurologist who specializes in brain injuries. He's a practicing neurologist here in Jacksonville who serves as a consultant for the Jacksonville Jaguars. Go Jags. He also works with military vets both in his office and at the Eisenhower Center, a brain trauma rehab here in Jacksonville, Florida, where he is a medical director. And he sees brain injury cases from various types of assaults, car crashes, home and industrial accidents. He joins us in studio today. Dr. Assad, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are so excited to get this season going. And I'm going to start off with just the most basic of questions for our audience. Get us all on the same speed and explain what are concussions and why are they of particular importance or concern?
Sure. Yeah, so concussions are basically mild traumatic brain injuries, and there's a huge spectrum when it comes to brain injuries. A severe traumatic brain injury is one where you're comatose for 24 hours. We use a scale called the Glasgow Coma Scale, and you have a score of 8 or less. So these are devastating injuries with skull fractures and brain bleeds and require, after the ER, it's the OR, ICU, inpatient rehab, and probably very serious long-term care. The other end of the spectrum is concussions. Again, not to be taken lightly, and I think historically, people were told, oh, you had your bell rung, big deal. You know, you can't remember your name. Well, 5 minutes later, when you can remember your name, you're fine and life is good. But I think with time, we've come to understand that concussions can have implications for athletes, for military vets, and for regular people. And occasionally, you can have more prolonged symptoms, even though in most cases they're expected to resolve. And I think with that, it's become an important topic of discussion, particularly in the realms that you're mentioning, which is sports-related concussions and military.
Why should we worry about having a concussion?
Sure. So there's many reasons, for that. But I think one important reason is if someone is concussed, they're prone to another injury while they're concussed. And so, for example, in the sports realm, if they return to play prematurely and sustain a second injury while their brain is trying to, it's really an energy crisis, and their brain is trying to recover from this energy crisis, they can have a much more significant injury called a second impact. So that's one of many reasons. Also, now that we understand it better than we ever have before, you can actually start rehabilitating an individual and minimize any long-term consequences if you identify and treat early. So I think those are just a couple of reasons why it's gaining more importance. And then, of course, we've all heard about people with recurrent brain injuries or recurrent concussions ending up with neurodegenerative diseases like CTE. So,
okay, that helps me to understand that. Now, I mentioned that you work, you're a consultant for the JAGS. You've done that for a long time. You also work with brain injury folks. Can you share some insights into your role? What does that mean when we say this?
Sure. So it's interesting. And I think neurologists started getting pulled into professional sports, I want to say maybe a decade and a half ago, with the increasing realization that concussions can have serious health consequences, and to be able to identify concussions, because sometimes it's not that obvious. And so back in 2011, I was with the Baptist Neurology Group, and I was asked to become a independent neurotrauma consultant, which means my role would have been, after an athlete is concussed, evaluate them and determine what would be an appropriate time for them to return to play, and also sort of the graduated return to play protocol. And then in 2013, they also started requiring an unaffiliated neurotrauma consultant. This was a neurologist or neurosurgeon on the sidelines to sort of give a second opinion to the team. And this was a contract with the NFL to say, okay, if a concussion took place, or if we think a concussion took place, and the team physician makes a decision, you know, we have a second opinion right there on the sidelines to say, okay, well, what, you know, do we think a concussion took place? And then the third role that I've had with the team is where athletes are referred to the office, you know, to usually deal with any more persisting issues after a concussion or post-traumatic migraines, things like that.
Let me ask you a question that has come up. I had three different people ask me this question, mm-hmm. and now I'm very curious when you triggered it when you were telling me the roles. The question is simple. Last year, there was that very famous NFL picture with, I believe, with the Dolphins.
Sure.
Where he kept playing. And the question is simple. Who makes the final call as to whether someone can continue to play or not right then and there?
Good question. And as far as I recall, back in 2013 when I was on the sidelines,
sure.
I think it was still the team physician, although
okay.
our input was important. I'm not sure if those rules
Understood.
Have changed in the interim and who's now making the final decisions. But yeah, I mean, as you saw in that case, even with a trained neurosurgeon who was the unaffiliated neurotrauma consultant, sometimes this can be missed.
If it's not an NFL team, what happens on like a high school or college? Is that same story?
Sure. So the guidelines for that is based on the consensus statement, and we have the sixth consensus statement on this based on the meeting in Amsterdam in 2022. And it's an evolving topic, just because as we learn more, as we have more evidence-based input, you know, the rules change, and for the better, because I think with every passing year, we're getting better. So usually in the high school and college athlete arena, those are usually the guidelines that we follow.
Okay. You mentioned that there's changes. What have been the advances that really have changed the way we look at concussions?
Sure. I think, first of all, I think there's more recognition of the condition and what it entails and the potential for long-term consequences. I think there's the recognition that recurrent concussions are cumulative, and someone who's had two or three or four, and if they have symptoms that are persisting for longer and longer, that certain interventions should be made. As far as identifying ways to decrease the risk of concussions, that's another topic. And now, again, we have evidence-based practices like in hockey, disallowing checking, body checking.
Sure.
Decreases the risk of concussions by 58%.
Wow.
So, that's a pretty significant number. Wearing mouth guards in hockey decreases your risk of concussions. I believe it's 28%. So pretty significant numbers if you add it all. Even just doing neuromuscular training and strengthening the neck muscles to prevent that whiplash.
Sure.
Decreases your risk of concussions. And so those are, all interventions that are helping us reduce them in the first place.
I guess the big question I would have with this is that help the listeners out there understand what are the typical symptoms. How do you know that someone has had a concussion clinically?
Sure. Yeah. So, for example, in the sports arena, if there is a helmet-to-helmet collision, which means there's blunt force trauma. And this is much more obvious because in boxing, a knockout punch is actually an induced concussion. We're actually causing a concussion because that's what causes the individual to get knocked out. But in order to have a concussion, you don't actually have to be knocked out. You can have, let's say you have blunt force trauma during football and you watch the athlete get up, look a little confused, stagger off the field to the sidelines. And when they're asked, what's going on, they're like, I don't know. And if you ask them what quarter they're in or what game they're playing or what today's date is, and they're confused about those, chances are you may be dealing with a concussion. Of course, you can do a sideline assessment and do some neurological testing that'll give you a little more of an idea of if the individual's been concussed, but I think that would be presenting. And then they could also complain of headaches, blurry vision, ringing in the ears, dizziness, light sensitivity. So those are some classic symptoms.
And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, it's football season, so we are talking concussions, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at jservin. I know you work with concussions in different scenarios and situations. Is there a different protocol for diagnosing concussions in sports versus a military context?
Yeah, so in the military context, a lot of individuals that I meet unfortunately sustained the concussion a long time ago, or maybe several concussions. This could have been a mortar attack. It could have been an IED explosion. Some of these military vets were unconscious for a few minutes, and then they had the typical headaches, blurry vision, unsteadiness, et cetera, insomnia. Many of these people, because they had concussions, recovered, and those are not the individuals I'm now seeing. But some of these individuals had symptoms that started at that particular point, or maybe after their second or third concussion, and then stayed with them. And then they discharged from the military, but over time, and again, I think the military has really developed their concussion diagnosis and treatment protocols, like Camp Lejeune.
Yeah, that's right.
And a few other Intrepid. We still see some of these military vets, for example, in the Eisenhower Center, where they come in for a 35-day program. So these are chronic, sufferers, and here we're looking for oculometric deficits and
which means?
Oh, I apologize. So changes with their eye movements.
Okay.
So if their eyes are moving from one target to another, they might overshoot or undershoot the target, or they might have difficulty fixating on a target. And these sound like not very important issues, but they actually become very important when, for example, if someone is trying to read and it causes a headache or makes them nauseous or, you know, so when you find that their eyes are not converging properly or you find that their eyes are overshooting or undershooting the target, you can actually put them through a rehab program to retrain their brains and their eyes to, you know, work properly. And similarly, there's an entity, and I'm going to use a fancy term here, sensory integration, where our brainstem has the ability to take all of our senses and integrate them and give them a coherent view of the world. And we take this for granted, but someone who's concussed, they have sensory disintegration.
Oh.
And so they feel more discombobulated. But again, you can put them through a physical therapy protocol of sensory integration and dynamic stability and get them to be functioning better. And so even if it's years after the fact, identifying these problems and treating them are very, very helpful.
So you're talking about management, and this is very interesting to hear that. But how has management of concussion, what do doctors suggest, or what should the patient be doing? How has that changed in sports and other areas?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. So as recently as 2004 and prior to that, we used to put people in what we called a cocoon therapy, where after a concussion, we would tell them, don't do anything. Don't watch TV. Don't play video games. Don't do anything until all your symptoms resolve. Turns out that was counterproductive. And so now the relative rest is really recommended for 2 days. So 2 days of relative rest. Yeah, it's been decreasing.
Really?
You know, it used to be, I think a few years ago, it was 2 to 5 days. And the latest, if you read the latest consensus statement, it's 2 days of relative rest, after which we start putting them through a rehab program or activity program. And the idea is, okay, if physical activity is going to cause symptoms, you want to put them through a program of sub-symptom threshold exercise. So you exercise to the point where you start getting symptoms, and that's, you know, and you just, you work out below that. So there's actually a protocol called the Buffalo Concussion Treadmill Test, and you can actually determine at what heart rate the symptoms start, and then you just, you know, stay below that.
Wow, that's interesting. There's so much discussion these days about mental health. What does a concussion do psychologically to a person?
Sure. And some of this is probably social and psychological. If I'm a high school athlete and that's my life and that's my passion, and now I'm being told I can't play for the rest of the season or until my symptoms resolve, I'm just not going to be very happy about that. But, you know, the parts of the brain that subserve mood are, you know, they're also parts of the brain, right? So the limbic system and the amygdala. And so sometimes after concussions, people can have more anxiety and they can have, you know, they can be sad, they can be depressed, depending on the scenario. For example, we were talking about the military scenario. There's a lot of PTSD, you know.
Sure.
If you're in a situation where you could have gotten killed, but you didn't get killed, but now you have flashbacks and nightmares and hypervigilance and, you know, so those are all part and parcel of these conditions. And I think are important to identify because sometimes that needs to be an important focus of treatment.
I brought this up when we were talking about who has the final say as to who gets to play. Is there any sense of direction for the balance point between the pressure for an athlete to continue in the game or a soldier to continue in the military theater versus, you know what, we should not, this is going to hurt long-term health?
You know, it's interesting. I've seen it both ways. I've seen it where the athlete themselves is very, very upset at me for telling them to hold off, you know,
sure,
while we're trying to get their brain to heal.
Right.
And you know, again, we, based on the latest recommendations, we do try to get them into the rehab and, you know, physical activity right away, but they may not be allowed to go back to contact or combat sport, you know, until we're comfortable that they can. And sometimes it's also, you know, it may be, let's say someone is at work and maybe their employer doesn't understand that, you know, because it's kind of an invisible condition. So they may not realize that there's still an issue going on, which is why this individual has to take breaks or needs to be in a quiet, dark room to get their work done and things like that.
As someone who practices and is surrounded by this issue all the time, what advice would you have for parents, coaches, mm-hmm. on how to recognize concussions? And what would be your big message to all these folks?
Sure. So I think, you know, I would definitely recommend understanding the scenarios where concussions take place. Again, if there's been blunt force trauma, if there's been impulsive forces imparted to the brain that cause sudden angular, rotational, translational forces on the brain. You know, the brain is the softest tissue in the body,
yeah.
And it's also compressible. And so if there's sudden jerking, you know, jostling of the brain, potentially that's a possibility. I think it'd be important to understand the signs and symptoms. So when, after such an impact, the individual has certain symptoms, the headaches, the visual changes, the ringing in the ears, balance problems, to identify that and to seek help. And then I think the other important message is to not stop participating in sports. It's better to continue to participate in sports. Just understand that there's going to be certain scenarios where you want to, you know, take a break and get checked out.
Can you share any success stories from your work in the field that kind of highlights this recovery and rehab after concussions?
Sure. Yeah. So it's very gratifying when you identify certain symptoms and after appropriate treatment, people start doing better. I was mentioning the eye abnormalities. So, for example, when we look at something close up, our eyes converge and our pupils constrict. And so if I'm looking at something far away and then looking at something close,
right,
that allows me to still read what I'm trying to read. With concussion, sometimes people can develop convergence insufficiency where their eyes don't converge. And that, when they try to read, it causes blurry vision and a headache. But so identifying that and putting them through either ocular rehab with a physical therapist or a rehab optometrist, or just giving them exercises that they can do on their own, when you improve their convergence and they can start reading again and they can, you know, and it doesn't give them a headache, again, it's very gratifying. And so I think the more we realize these things, understand these things, and then help patients get better, you know, the more grateful they are and the more, you know, gratifying our job is.
I love hearing these different therapies. Where do people get them? Is it what kind of doctor? Who do you call for this?
So probably in town, a comprehensive program is Brooks Rehab, where they do have all of these different components in one place. But I think there's other places that are picking up on and getting certified in concussion physical therapy and offering it to their patients. I was actually, just before this meeting today, I was talking to two physical therapists from, I think they call themselves Bold City Physical Therapy.
Okay.
And they just got certified and they're very excited to work with us. And so I think it's gaining traction and people are realizing that this is an important component. There are, there's a optometrist who specializes in ocular rehab in town, Dr. James Horning. So when we have difficult cases and they haven't benefited, sometimes I'll refer to him and he'll be able to do therapy as well.
How do you envision the future of what concussion care may look like, either on the battlefield or on the sideline of a sports activity?
Sure. So actually, the consensus statement talked about how we have blood biomarkers and cerebrospinal fluid biomarkers and brain imaging and brain EEGs and all this other technology. They feel that these are great research tools, but at least as far as the sidelines is concerned, they still are keeping it as a purely clinical assessment. However, I do feel that in the future, and particularly for more protracted cases, if you have symptomatology going on beyond 4 weeks, I think it's a really good idea to use some of this technology to help us better gauge where we're at. And then also, then if we're putting people through therapy, I can gauge the progress through therapy if I've done dynamic posturography or if I've done formal oculometric testing.
I want to make sure we give time for you to kind of give some, I know you gave some advice overall, but what key takeaway do you hope our listeners will gain on listening to this discussion on concussions and its impact on health?
Sure. Yeah. So I think the key message is concussion in most cases is a self-limited condition. And that covers about 85% of the total. So 85% of people who have concussions are expected to get better in a few days, a few weeks, or within a month. And so the key recommendation is understand it, identify it, have it diagnosed and treated early to prevent chronification. And if it does start becoming more chronic, seek medical help so we can help you get better. Don't let that prevent you from doing the activities you enjoy. I go skiing every year. I know that there's risks involved.
Yes.
Right? I mountain bike. I know there's risks involved with that. But, you know, just as long as we know to stop and get evaluated and treated when that's required to prevent it becoming a long-term problem.
Just two last quick questions. Number one, does someone have to get an MRI should they have a concussion?
So in most cases, no. And actually, you don't always even need to get a CAT scan. You know, there are some signs and symptoms. For example, if you have intractable headaches and vomiting and you think that maybe you might have had a subdural bleed or something like that where a CT scan is required. In the acute setting, you don't usually need an MRI. However, if there are chronic symptoms and you are worried about damage to the white matter tracts or microhemorrhages in the brain or things like that, there are new sequences that help us look at those things. And in the future, there are centers that are working on special sequences like arterial spin echo labeling and spectroscopy and even functional MRI, bold imaging,
sure,
that is going to give us even more insight. Right now, these are all research tools.
Last point, just to kind of highlight something you said earlier. Should someone get a concussion, they should take rest for 2 days.
Correct.
And 2 days of doing nothing?
Yeah, two days of relative rest. I mean, they should basically continue their everyday activities, but certainly if there's any activity that triggers symptoms, they should take it easy. And then beyond 2 days, if they're still having symptoms, I would recommend starting with your primary care doctor, and then if there's still ongoing issues, seeking you know, the help from a brain injury specialist.
Dr. Saad, this has been so helpful. I just want to thank you so much for giving us some time of your very busy day today to help us out and have this good discussion with us.
All right. Thank you so much for inviting me. This was a lot of fun. And I love your program, so please, please keep up the great work.
I did not pay him to say that, so thank you for that. We have been talking to Dr. Saad Assad. He is a distinguished neurologist who specializes in brain injuries. He serves as a consultant for the Jacksonville Jaguars and works with military vets both in his office and at the Eisenhower Center, a brain trauma rehab here in Jacksonville. And up next, navigating health misinformation. And we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and this is What's Health Got to Do with It? Your weekly dose of illuminating insights into the world of medical health care. In March 2020, the Secretary General of the World Health Organization declared an infodemic concurrent with the COVID-19 pandemic. 3 years later, COVID is still around. But what about the infodemic and health information writ large? Our next guest, Dr. Christy Roschke, returns to our program to let us know where we're at and to help us continue to unravel the intricate web of health misinformation. She's a prominent authority in media literacy and co-director of the News CoLab at Arizona State University, and will guide us through the labyrinth of falsehoods and misconceptions that impact our well-being. Because in the realm of health, separating fact from fiction is not just crucial, it's a matter of life and death. Dr. Roschke joins us from Phoenix. So good to have you back.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me back again.
You bet. Well, Dr. Roschke, I always ask this question when we've had you on the show in the past, but just to catch all listeners up to speed, what is health misinformation, just as a general definition?
Sure. So I think that we can consider any information related to health and wellness and medicine and some of that broad topic that is inaccurate, not credible, not trustworthy sources, anything that is not, the best possible evidence that we have at the moment.
When we spoke last year, there's a lot of things going on, and there's a lot going on this year as well. Is health misinformation still as rampant as when we last spoke a year ago, or even back in 2020?
I think that it is still a really big problem. There probably is not as much, rampant misinformation specifically related to the pandemic, to COVID right now. But there is plenty of other, areas of health where we can fill that gap. And there is still plenty of misinformation and misconceptions about COVID out there today. But I think, especially at the start of the pandemic, there was just so much information in general, right? Good, bad, or otherwise, that we're not seeing that volume currently, but certainly, misinformation related to health continues to be a problem.
There was a recent Journal of the American Medical Association editorial which asked a very specific question. They wondered what had happened to the NIH research program on health communication, which was supposed to gear against misinformation. What do we know happened, if you know anything, with regards to that program? Because that kind of took me a little by surprise when I saw that editorial.
Yeah, so I don't have the specifics, and I'm not sure anyone has the specifics of why the program has been paused, but I think there are some interesting dynamics that are occurring politically that may have had something to do with it. There has been a lot of, I guess, scuttlebutt, as it were, about this concept of mis and disinformation, generally speaking, and especially as it relates to politics. And so, as so often happens, this idea of misinformation has been politicized, and it has become sort of a political tool in this debate against sort of like censorship and free speech and what can and what should and shouldn't be removed from social media platforms and that sort of thing. And so I think this NIH program, in addition to some other government-funded programs within the federal government, but also at, public universities, have become sort of the subject of scrutiny, which is really disappointing because these programs serve to help us make better information decisions, but they are sort of being used, I think, as tools to suggest that the government is trying to censor certain unpopular information.
Got it. Can you give us any recent examples of health misinformation that you've recently come across?
Yeah, so I think that there is sort of an ongoing barrage of misinformation as it relates to, I would say the wellness industry. So people who are, you know, maybe fitness influencers or are talking about different supplements or vitamins or things that you can do to make yourself look and feel better. These markets are, you know, as you know, heavily unregulated. And so a lot of this comes down to whether or not you want to believe what a particular maybe social media personality has to say about a product. And oftentimes this comes with some sort of purchase opportunity, right? And so I think that kind of, maybe it's not entirely misinformation because maybe these supplements work just fine, or maybe they are helpful for some people, or even a placebo effect makes people feel good about themselves. But the fact that these are unregulated and it's unproven and untested, and these types of posts are very popular on things like TikTok and Instagram, I think that's an example of something that I continue to see and that I think my students, my college students struggle with.
I know no one is here to blame, and this is not a political show, but is there any factor or group or whatever that is principally to blame on this whole issue of health misinformation, or is there multiple actors here?
Oh, I think there are multiple actors, and I think there are also multiple factors, right? So there's a lot of different reasons why people would want to mislead when it comes to health. And, you know, one I just mentioned is for profit or for grift. You know, there's plenty of grifters out there with the latest, you know, get healthy quick schemes. And, you know, there's also a lot of confusion around traditional medicine and access to healthcare being a problem for a lot of people in the U.S. I don't think that that helps when people don't have regular access to a healthcare provider, they turn to other sources for information. And that's where, you know, you just can find anything. And then, you know, as I mentioned, politics and cultural differences do play a big role in what we decide, what information we decide to use, right? We want to take information that's useful to us, and depending on the way we view the world, that might be different from what conventional or consensus experts would tell us. So it's really tough. And you know, also I think we're still kind of reeling from this idea that science and health and medicine are ongoing discovery. And what might be the best recommendation today may not be the best recommendation tomorrow. So we continue to see people be very confused over, you know, whether or not they should vaccinate for COVID or should get the latest booster. Those kinds of things. It's just a really, it's a moving target. And that is very confusing for people.
How do you balance the individual's right to free speech when it comes to health information or misinformation? Because I'm sure these folks, I'll say, well, I have a right to speak. What's the balance point from a pragmatic standpoint on this?
That's a great question. And I mean, I guess I would say that when it comes to communicating on private companies' platforms, an individual really has no constitutional right to free speech. The First Amendment specifically covers speech that is censored by the government. And so when we're talking about, you know, Meta or TikTok, we don't have that right to say whatever we want. I think the platforms generally try to stay away from removing content under the sort of auspices of free speech. But because algorithms work as they do, and you know, when you are talking to a friend, that's an audience of one. But when you're talking on a platform, a social media platform, that's a potential audience of tens, hundreds, maybe even millions of something, you know, hits the algorithm the right way. And so it's a really different conversation than, you know, just sort of like free speech in the public square. But it is a difficult balance because the platform companies want to keep their customers happy. And there is a large contingent of folks that believe that removing any content, even if it's false and harmful, is tantamount to censorship. So some of this is an education problem, right? Just people not understanding their rights as it relates to the terms of service of different technology platforms. But then that becomes a political talking point. So it is quite complicated. And I think that everyone's kind of in a tricky position, especially those platforms that are designed to give people a place to say things. They're very reluctant to remove any speech at all, and so they really rely on their hate speech policies and their terms of use to say specifically what kinds of content that they will remove.
You know, Dr. Roschke, when I scan Twitter or its new name X, I see a lot of health misinformation. What advice do you have for folks about how you can detect misinformation?
Well, I think that for most of us, this may seem like simple advice, but especially when it comes to health, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is not true. That sort of old adage still stands to be the case for most things, right? It's like, just because people can say things online, there are so many ways in which you can fool someone with visuals and graphics and clever editing and filters. And the more you can understand about how the platforms work, I think the better you will be at deciphering some of these things. And then another sort of old adage that certainly predates social media, but is like, who's the messenger and what do they stand to gain from the message? I'm guilty of following a lot of celebrities on Instagram. I find it fascinating, and I will admit that sometimes if a celebrity has some sponsored content with a particular brand or something, I might be like, hey, that seems kind of cool. But I always can check myself and say, wait a second, there's a reason that this particular person is sending this particular message. And when I look at it from that viewpoint, I usually stop myself from buying the product or believing that it might, make a big difference in my life. So I think there's a certain amount of trusting your instincts, even as social media can be so confusing and messages just being thrown at us all the time. Who's giving us these messages and why, I think, is a pretty good, thing to be rolling in your head as you're thinking about this.
Dr. Roschke, can you give us a good example of media handling this issue well, like that you've seen, that is a cool way of combating health misinformation?
That's a great question. And, there are different techniques. And I think what's important is that media companies, whether they're news media companies or other types of media, try a variety of different tactics, right? Because different things will work on different people. So there are some news organizations that have very robust fact-checking mechanisms, for instance, and they can kind of line by line, point by point, go through some information and explain why it is credible or not. And that fact-checking will work very well on a particular percentage of the population. There are others for whom fact-checking just doesn't do it, right? And so then that's when you might need things like labels. Social media labeling has been shown in different research studies to be pretty effective in curbing the spread of misinformation. It may not change people's beliefs, and certainly converting people's beliefs is the most difficult part of all of this. But when we're talking about, the propensity for misinformation to go viral, keeping people from sharing something that might be false is really what we're after. And so different labels or warnings that platforms have put into place are also a great tool. I've also seen some researchers and other organizations develop games about misinformation that really teach people how influence works online, and those can be fun tools for people as well.
Is this issue of health misinformation, is this an American problem? Or does this reach beyond our shores? Is this global and we're all simply trying to deal with this?
Oh, it is definitely a global problem. I would say that having said that, I think that the U.S. does export a lot of the health misinformation to the rest of the world, but the rest of the world also struggles with its own different types of health misinformation. And, you know, whether that's I don't know, challenges between maybe traditional or cultural treatments for different diseases versus Western medicine's version of that, or if it's, you know, again, sort of misinformation around COVID that has taken all kinds of shapes and sizes around the world. And then different platforms are the culprits in, or different actors are the culprits in different places. And so in some parts of the world, you can see governments actively misinforming their publics on health. And in other places, it might be word of mouth. But this is definitely not strictly an American phenomenon. And it requires, again, sort of multiple techniques and tactics to tackle it in different regions of the world.
Dr. Rusher, do you think that all of this stems from the fact that there's this huge time crunch with physicians or health providers and their patients? You get maybe 10, maybe 15 minutes if you're lucky with a busy a physician or provider. Is this kind of the crux of the problem, that it's just there's no time with someone that you could trust?
I think that's a big part of the problem. Access to a provider who can spend some time is hugely important when it comes to trust. Some colleagues and I just finished some research on this very topic, in fact, and we found that people were most trusting of the healthcare providers who were able to spend time, quality time, you know, getting to know them, and there being some sort of continuity of care there. Even if that's as simple as, you know, having read the chart before walking into the room, so there's a semblance of like, hey, I know you and I know what's going on with you. And then that combined with the obvious expertise that comes with having gone to medical school and earned certain certifications and been in the profession for a while, that combination of personal experience and expertise is really key to developing trustworthy relationships. And also found, and think a good important point for healthcare providers, is the role that they play in disseminating information. I think it's pretty common these days for people to come to a doctor with some idea of what's going on with them, right? Because they've already Googled their symptoms. And having that conversation between doctor and patient about, well, this is what I think's going on, and the doctor being able to say, well, maybe it's that, but also maybe it's this, and letting it be a conversation about what the best facts and evidence are in this case. That's kind of a real 2023 way to make sure that people are getting the best information they can get when they visit a doctor.
Dr. Roschke, in our last moment, I wonder if you could provide any guidance or advice for our listeners that are hearing our conversation, and just wonder what you would say, what should be the key takeaway from today's conversation, and what they should do to kind of combat and detect misinformation as it pertains to health?
Sure. When it comes to your health, I think it's always important to seek out the experts. You know, better if you have a personal relationship, but it doesn't. That's not always the case for people. So who is the expert in this situation? You know, what kind of expertise does a physician need to have to be able to tell me something about, you know, insert health problem here? Don't be swayed by the glossy, fancy things you see online. I mean, to a certain extent, those things can be harmless, but you want to question the qualifications of folks who are popular online, if they've really earned that popularity through, you know, health expertise, legitimate health expertise, and you know, and trust the fact checkers, right? Like, there are a large group of people who are working to make sure that the health information that you see is credible and accurate. And so when you are unsure about a piece of health information, be sure to check it against a credible source or an expert in your community, so that you can, again, always have the best available evidence to help you make decisions.
Dr. Rusher, I'm going to let that be our final word. I just want to thank you so much for giving us this conversation, the opportunity to have it, and for always joining us on our program when it comes to this issue.
It is really my pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
We've been talking to Dr. Christy Roschke. She's a prominent authority in media literacy and co-director of the News CoLab at Arizona State University. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Heather Schatz is our senior producer. Brady Corum is our director. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Next week's program is an update on the latest treatments for mental health. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tweet me at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch. Watch me walking.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And by the Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today.